Sarah.
Hi, Nick Revel. Sabrina George here. Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you basically because you've had quite a long history involved in the contemporary, as in what sometimes people call alternative comedy scene, going back away. And so I just wanted to talk to you a bit about it and talk to you about your thoughts and feelings. And let's start off with what got you into doing stand-up specifically.
Okay, well, I guess the, you know, what interests you in comedy is a mixture of, you know, what you like on TV and everything. And my initial ambition was to be next kind of Monty Python, you know, because there wasn't really...
Is this as a child?
Yeah, you know, teenager and that. Because all the stand-up, really, with the exception of Billy Connolly and Dave Allen, if you like, you felt was very conventional and, you know, when you're at that age that you don't want to listen to anything or watch anything that your parents like, you know. Then Monty Python and that kind of comedy represented that. Then when alternative stand-up started in this country in the story, what, 79, 80, I think there were two things. Firstly, the fact that that was happening. And seeing Richard Pryor, the first movie that he ever, the big movie that he got released, which is, you know, Richard Pryor Live. It was about 1979, 1980. And it was just extraordinary because really hadn't seen stand-up being used that way. I mean, as I say, Connolly and Dave Allen I was a fan of, but Richard Pryor had this different element. With all this kind of physicality and seeming to populate the stage with characters, and there was a real dynamic performance side to it. So he had all these incredible levels and it just kind of revealed what stand-up could be.
You saw that in the cinema?
Saw that in the cinema, and that was around about the same time that the Comedy Store was starting off. And went down the Comedy Store, died on my ass, but the bug had bitten. And
what were you doing in your real life then? Were you working in a bookstore or?
I just left university, and I was selling a few. I was writing gags for the radio and a bit for TV. I was writing on a radio program called Weekending, and I'd sold about two or three little quickies.
So comedy was definitely going to be
not the Nine O'Clock News.
Part
yeah,
of your future.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I always wanted to do it. Yeah.
And what were you doing reading at university?
French and German.
Very good.
Modern and medieval languages.
Is that the same as Murray's? Al Murray, didn't he do French and German? And he did modern, I think he did politics.
Ah, right. One of those.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So you went to the store, you died on your arse. How did you prepare? How did the performer prepare to go to the store? Did you actually write gags? Did you cod somebody else's act together or...?
I had a character that I'd been doing in a review show who was quite surreal. And I knew that it worked pretty consistently in the right kind of environment. So I'd never been to the store before I actually went down there and gigged.
That's the word, the right kind of environment.
Well, you know what it's like. Some stuff is right for a theatre or for, you know, whatever it might be. And I knew that it was quite vicious down at the store. So I thought, well... will I go and have a look first? But that would have cost me £4 or whatever the entrance fee was. Whereas if you were performing, you got in for free, obviously. So I thought, right, well, that's a saving. And so I thought, well, if I do something that I know works in the right kind of environment, then at least it's not going to be a case of, well, you can't do it because it didn't work, you know. So I went down and watched the gig. And as I said, I didn't exactly darn my ass, but you know, the first half went okay, but I was only doing 4 or 5 minutes.
And how did you get gigs at the store in those
You days? Just basically rang up and said, hello, I'd like to have a gig at the store, please. There weren't a lot of people doing it at that time.
So it wasn't a massive waiting list?
No, not at all.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think you probably have two or three booked acts, and then part of the whole danger and excitement was the fact that there was the audience spot. You could just, you know, if you remember the audience, you could get up and do 5 minutes if you lasted that long. People could turn up and just do, most people were doing 5 minutes, and you'd have two or three people who would be doing 20 minutes.
And you would turn up at 8 and it would sort of shambolically go until everyone had fallen asleep?
No, it started at midnight.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, there was only one show to begin with, and it started at midnight. And
after the strippers had left.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was. It was fantastic. It was just so weird, this kind of collision of worlds. You know, you had all this kind of politically committed comedy in the broadest sense, that it was all coming out of the, you know, the sort of lefty bohemian areas of society, and it was in this strip club in Dean Street, but it was a fantastic atmosphere up there, you know. I mean, the Nell Gwynn Club had been a really trendy place in the 20s and 30s, where people like Noel Coward and all that set used to hang out, and then this, you would go up in this lift four at a time, and there was the doorman reminded me of the barman in The Shining. He was very polite and ageless, and he'd clearly been working there for years, and you'd be seen into the lift four at a time, you'd come out of the lift and you'd walk down this Art Deco staircase, which I later discovered had been designed by Matisse. It was just,
really?
Yeah, incredible.
Is it still there?
No, I think it probably got trashed when the building got redone a few years ago. But anyway, so you would walk into this room down this staircase, and it was a curiously kind of groovy little world of its own. Yeah, but yeah, it was a strip club, and you'd be sitting in the toilet before a gig, got to get ready, and you'd hear people say, "What is this place anyway? I don't know, but you can drink lager till 4 in the morning." So, you know, you had people who were just there because they'd heard that something happened and you could drink late, you know, you've got to remember.
And did some of the punters stay on from the girls wearing their raincoats and stay on to the comedy? Were they all turfed out?
No, I think you'd probably be turfed out. Yeah. And you'd have to pay again, definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But was it generally quite well attended?
It was generally rammed, yeah, but it was an incredible mixture in the audience. You know, you had people who were there to support the acts and support the whole idea of, you know, alternative comedy, to put it simply, really was like the comedy equivalent of punk,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So you had that, but then you had the traditional audiences of people who just wanted to drink late. You had people who heard, oh, it's comedy. And then we'd get really offended when anybody did anything, you know, political or left-wing. You had quite a lot of soldiers, and especially during the Falklands. And
stuff. Really? Yeah. And were they sympathetic, or were they...?
Generally speaking, although a friend of mine reminded me recently that he was in fear of my life one night when there was a bunch in... who'd been out in the Falklands, and they said, don't you dare talk about the Falklands, I've just been out there, which of course made me do more. But, you know, I never did stuff like that sort of irresponsibly, I don't think. But my friend reminded me that certain threats had been passed on, and that I talked to one of them afterwards, and I said, look, you know, that's the way I feel about it, blah, blah, blah. And he took my argument, while one of his cohorts was saying within my friend's earshot, but not in mine, what should we do with him, sir? And my friend was convinced that I was going to get taken.
You're going to get parts of your body thrown out the window. I mean, now, comics generally, when they're together, they talk about other promoters, other clubs, and getting a tight 10, 20-hour show for Edinburgh. Sometimes they talk about how would I tighten up that story or whatever.
Mm.
What were people talking about then? Because the concept of a tight 5:20, whatever, wasn't really... How did comics talk to each other about comedy? Do you remember?
God, I'm trying to think. Well, for a start, even at that point, you had quite a wide hierarchy, if you like, amongst the comedians. I mean,
there was.
I started doing it in 1980, right? So by that time, the comic strip had started as a live show, which was Alexei Sale, Rick Mayall, Aid Edmondson, The Outer Limits, which was Peter Richardson and Nigel Plain. All that lot had gone off to the Raymond Review bar. You know, there was this incredible sort of positive... creative rivalry between strip club owners. You know, Don Ward had started the Comedy Store, and then what's his name, Paul Raymond gets into it with the comic strip and so on. So there's a curious kind of synergy there. But, you know, that lot, you were always a bit in awe or trepidated by them until you got to know them a little bit better. I mean, people like Keith, yeah, they were all still playing the store, but I mean, you know, Keith Allen, Tony Allen, those kind of people, you know, you'd talk to him more than maybe the others. You didn't see him much, and obviously you were on a lower rung. I think we were just finding it out, really. I mean, God, I don't know. What would you talk about? Maybe there was a bit more discussion of, you know, what was going on in the world. I mean, the other weird thing was, you know, because it's easy to forget it was such a different time politically in this country, you know. And as I say, I really stress. Yeah, I mean, that period, 79 to 82, 83, you had riots, you had the Falklands War, you had cruise missiles and Greenham Common and marches, and there was a real sense of, a much more of a sense of polarisation, I think.
Because also, my memory of that time was when I was sort of like running away from home a lot, and there was squats, there was feeling of ease, of availability of social security money.
Mm.
So that pressure, which I feel is on a lot of newish comics at the moment, of having to get another source of income,
yeah,
to get themselves going. I don't know whether that made an impact, whether comics could actually feel much freer about, you know, just getting on with experimenting and finding their feet without this tremendous pressure of when am I going to get my next paycheck.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably true, actually. And the other thing, of course, was that, you know, the other reason the pressure wasn't so great is that there weren't many paid gigs, you know.
There probably wasn't that much on access to telly.
Oh, no, not really. I mean, we all knew we wanted to make a living as a comedian, but there was no clear sense of how you would go about that. You know, there was the odd little bit of TV here and there, you know, but there was nothing regular. And as I say, there's probably, I don't know, about half a dozen gigs in London, and then every so often there'd be a gig out of town. But, you know, if you were working once a week, that was a big deal, really. I think maybe, you know, you asked, you know, what did comics talk about? As I say, you know, there weren't that many comics, so you didn't hang out with them the whole time. You know, it wasn't like now, you know, you can guarantee that you're going to be in a car with four other comedians twice a week or whatever it might be. So, you know, those kind of conversations didn't necessarily happen just because of the fact that there was fewer gigs. Also, so you didn't hang out with comics so much, really.
So I just imagine this sort of world where after your one weekly or one bi-monthly or whatever it was gig, that you would sort of go to one of the late night grotty places that still exist in Soho and sit there and chow down about how much further you could push the extremities of whatever you were doing with each other. Or I just imagine this sort of, because I wasn't there, this wonderful sort of golden age of people really endorsing that, because at the moment I feel there's a lot of pressure to conform.
Yeah, I think there probably is, because as you say, that, you know, because it's become so much more mainstream and much more, you know, the commercial essence of it now is doing a good tight set, whereas then, because it was all anarchic in the broadest sense of the word, you know, because it was new and people didn't know what they were doing, part of the commercial attraction was just simply the fact that the gig could go tits up at any moment, you know. There'd be heckling and there'd be people who didn't know what they were doing, people who thought they knew what they were doing and discovered that they didn't, you know. So it was really, really volatile, and that was part of the commercial attraction. So if you split the room in any way, that was a positive, whereas now it's not. I'm trying to cast my mind back. We used to just piss around a lot afterwards, and just, you know, the other comics who I did hang out with, like Paul Merton and John Irwin and people like that, we used to go for a Chinese, and then we'd go back to usually my place because it was slightly bigger, because I shared a flat rather than being in a bedsit, and we'd get stoned, get drunk, and just sort of piss around. It was like, you know, we were just, it was a bit like being in a kind of little comedy improvised movie, really, where, you know, I remember one time Paul Merton appearing around the corner in our living room with a piece of soap on a fork, which he'd bitten a mouthful out of. Now, not quite sure why that was so hysterically funny to all of us, so I can't really remember the setup. But that seemed sort of quite normal, but at the same time hysterically funny, you know. So, yeah, we just it was more of a kind of just, let's have a laugh now and carry on trying to make each other laugh, actually.
Yeah, you know,
that was probably
the key. Sometimes I think it sort of does surprise newer comics to see how serious most comics are at the moment, sitting amongst each other and sitting there, you know, where's the next pay gig? How do you get there? How do you... And sitting there, this is supposed to be about comedy, but actually it's turned into quite a lot of jobs for us going on as well.
Well, I suppose once you see a career path, then you get people... I mean, you've got to have that sense of trying to make a living out of it. You've got to have a drive. But I think it's sad when people lose sight of the fact that, you know...
The fun of it all.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I really
chewing
do.
Soap for a laugh. So you carried on performing then for a while, and then presumably got better?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, every
dropped
gig
the character,
did.
Kept the character, did
I? Oh, the
characters
went pretty quickly, and I started to try and develop an act which was based on... You know, on me. Although I did used to do characters sometimes as well. You know, I still did a little bit of review stuff, trying to sort of make it a bit more updated. But yeah, mainly aiming towards getting a set that was the basic voice was me.
You were called satirical.
Mm.
Was that one? Was that what you meant to go in, or did that happen? And two, for those people, I'm thinking about countries where maybe satire is not part of their vocabulary. How do you understand what you do as a satirical comic?
Well, my basic opinion is really, you know, the most important thing is just making the audience laugh. And I've always liked to do topical stuff and therefore a certain amount of satirical stuff, but I've never really done it from a consistent political position, because I just don't really have one, you know. And it's not as if I want to, you know, actively try and change the world through doing a joke. but I do enjoy trying to make jokes on the main stories that might be around in the papers or in people's heads.
So would you say that's more sort of debunking is what goes through your head?
Yeah, I think so. And I think in a way, you know, that's all you can hope. That seems to me the best attitude to have, you know, because otherwise you can lose sight of the fact that the laughter is important. And getting, you know, anybody can voice an opinion onto an audience. And sometimes I'm guilty of doing that if I get angry about something, you know. So I always try and remind myself that actually, you know, it must be punctuated by laughs, you know, rather than just becoming a politician who's
because
not actually running for election.
Going up the wrong
yeah.
Of any sort.
Yeah, that's right. That's very funny. Yeah. The audience starts saluting. You might be missing a certain set of the essential points.
At the moment, we've got the Hamza having his trial going on and watching. And I just thought it was such a brilliant thing as that. He can't develop a salute because both his hands are metal.
Yeah.
He's got he's actually now every single photograph he's got his hands in his pockets.
Yeah.
And they're not even out. You know. And it's just sort of, oh bless. He can't even develop a salute because
you can't really call him a wanker. It occurred to me.
That's also frightening to think what he might have to do.
Oh, that's all.
Alone in his prison cell.
See, what's sad thing is once I'd got to the wanker joke, I left it there. You're taking it on. He's also a huge fan of Hitler, of course, which confuses the hell out of the BNP, which I think is hilarious. Yeah.
Everything he's done is very confusing.
And his encyclopedia of jihad. I struck me, how did he buy that? Was it, you know, salesman at the door in traditional encyclopedia selling fashion? Hello, so I was just wondering if you've ever had a burning desire to create global hatred and bloodshed. I have, but I've never had...
And educate your children and friends.
Yes, but I've often had the bloodlust, but I've never found a consistent intellectual foundation. Well, here we are. This could be just what you're looking for.
I think that my parents had the 1956 version of the Encyclopedia Britannica, all 50 volumes or whatever it was, and it was actually very similar probably to the version that Hamza would have appreciated. It's not very... It's when Britain still owned most of the world.
Yeah.
And a lot lot of pink on the maps and stuff. So I think, yes. But no, I do feel for him lonely nights in the years ahead in his prison cell with just a couple of bits of metal to warm him up. And
well, maybe you can get different attachments.
Maybe that's what he could do in his woodworking class.
Mind you, if he got flexible enough, he's only got one eye. There's an empty socket there.
He's buggered as far as like developing a look for his followers.
Of course, he really could be completely innocent. You know, the trial's still going on. We don't want to prejudice the trial.
Yeah, he probably could be. That would be fascinating, miscarriage of justice, if he was innocent, given that they found, what is it, 20,000 videotapes of extraordinary speeches.
Could have been planted.
It could have been planted.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I am Abu Hamza's body double.
Your hands firmly in your pocket because you didn't have claws. So, getting back to... So you sort of evolved into a satirical comic.
Yeah, but as I say, I don't think, you know, it's more responding to just what's going on around it. And I know that's a nice distinction, a delicate distinction. But as I say, I've never really had a particular axe to grind. So,
right.
You know, I'd say topical, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great that people often in reviews pick up on that side of it, because I figure, well, some of the lines might be quite savage,
to,
you know, but...
it's a great title, a satirical comic, rather than a genial mentioner of things that are happening in the paper.
I suppose, yeah, actually, when you look at it that way.
Feel to it.
I like to look at it as sort of topical, satirical, with a certain amount of elegant, really high-class filth thrown in as well.
So particularly, to keep everybody
yeah,
happy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you're not frightened of showing your education as a comic either, which I think is quite nice.
Well, only in the sense that, you don't want to feel like you seem like you're showing off, but at the same time, I just think, well, if if stuff occurs to you, then it's more honest to try and find a way of making it on stage rather than just keep it all sort of
thick.
Crude and thick. Yeah, you know. So I just try.
Tony Blair, I couldn't. Jewish comics are going to go with that one. Tony Blair is a cunt.
Yeah.
So you were quite along doing this, and then what sort of happened? Did people invite you to come and work on things? Did you think what the media world needs is me to start writing things for them? How did it evolve, the writing side?
I would say most of the writing I've done has been stuff that I've been asked to write, although... Sometimes, you know, you come up with an idea for a...
But when you started to show. Go into it?
When I started, Weekending was this long-running Radio 4 satirical, topical show, and I started writing on that, and then wrote on the News Headlines as well, which is a show that Roy Hudd did, which was really, really good fun. Because that was a great balance between writing satirical, very sharp satirical gags, and then more sort of end-of-the-pier stuff, and Roy was brilliant at mixing the two up. You know, it was great. And then I worked with Andy Hamilton quite a lot, who's a really great comic, well, mainly writer, but also performer and producer and director. And we worked together doing a live show, which then turned into a radio series called
Million Pound Radio Show.
Yeah, yeah.
I love Andy Hamilton.
He's just terrific.
He's very, very attractive, and
he's brilliant.
He's absolutely fantastic.
He's such a nice guy. And we worked together. We did a live show, and then we did about on and off. We did this series for about 10 years as a double act. And again, that was sort of topically inspired, but broader than just satirical. And that was really good fun.
Would you meet every week, sit down across the kitchen table, and pretend to write material?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we'd have meetings, go away, write separately, rewrite together, blah, blah, blah. So we did that for a while. So that was self-generated. And then I did a sitcom called The Nick Revel Show, which backpitched the idea and a couple of other things. And then, Andy was responsible, but half of the team responsible for Drop the Dead Donkey, which was a TV sitcom with a topical satirical element, and I got invited to write on that by him and Guy Jenkin, And then that I got
was
asked.
Mega successful.
Yeah, it was a really good show.
Because the I don't really know much about the inner workings of it. The premises I understand it was that you would have a storyline each week, but then you'd take it up to the wire of filming to have lots of space to put in topical.
That's right. Yeah.
So sometimes it would almost be an hour before filming you were putting stuff on, which is a tremendous vibe.
Yeah, I suppose in extraordinary circumstances, you know, something huge had broken, you would be writing up to that point, and then and then we would write a little bit for the end credits. On it would be recorded on a Wednesday and go out on a Thursday, whatever it was. And we would write something on the Thursday, you know, for the end credits as well. So yeah, it was very topical. It was very good fun to work on. It was a sitcom with a very topical
element.
Why did
that come to an end? Because I thought that was the sort of show that could have lasted.
I suppose it could. I mean, I think to a certain extent, you know, any show gets to a point where it starts to entropy sets in.
Right.
And I think it was really a feeling of that. But I think it probably could have gone on for a little longer.
Yeah, it's changed, fired some of the characters, got new characters. I don't know, I just thought the premise of that idea. Because I can't remember, I can't remember what it was. There was something that I remember thinking, I'm dying to see what Drop the Dead on do about that, because it was, as you say, it was 24 hours after the event, whether they'd get it in or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And how they would, and whether they'd have enough time. Because that's the other thing I meant to ask you about doing topical and political stuff, is I'm brilliant at writing stuff 5 years after the event.
Yeah.
I need a long gestation period to think about what I think about and distance myself and then process. Is that something you just don't have to do? Or do you find there's ways you can just quickly go, oh, war's about to happen, write jokes?
Yeah, I think I'm really glad that I started writing for a topical show at the very beginning, because it did teach you to be able to write quickly and find ways of coming up with something at a day's notice or half a day's notice or whatever it might be. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not. I think generally in topical programs, it really helps if there's a few of you bouncing the ideas together.
Yeah.
When you're working on your own as a stand-up, it can be harder. I think it comes down to the fact that you just have to keep doing it. It's like practice, you know. Like, you know, generally I'll read 3 papers a day and try and write a few one-liners every day. I won't even worry if they're good or not, but just keeping the discipline going. So
machinery
that
oiled,
Yeah, exactly. And then inevitably the really good gag will always just pop in, or 9 times out of 10 it will pop into your head rather than be the product of that kind of work. But at the same time, I think you do generate a lot of good material that way. And you know, I think it's a really important thing to remember that it's a very low return, you know, the number of good gags the number of good gags you will write compared to the number of gags you write.
Well, of course, if it's totally topical, you've got to get rid of it the minute the
Although there are ways that you can give them a longer shelf life by just a different setup, or indeed the way that they come round again and again. I was just trying to think, I don't know, somebody said to me yesterday, reminded me of a line about how, well, later on in the show we'll be looking at the typing error that started the Iran-Iraq war. So that must be 20-odd years ago. And you're thinking, it's probably just about, in another couple of years we'll be using that again. Or, line like, do you ever get the feeling that ceasefire is Yugoslavian for reloading? Well, I've used that in about 4 different languages, you know. Do you ever get the feeling that ceasefire is Arabic for reloading, or Israeli for reloading, or Congolese for reloading? You know, you can actually, with certain shapes, you can...
Stockwell Station, if I can remember that far back. What was that, 6 months ago?
Yeah.
Yes, killing the Brazilian. So you were sort of happily pottering along. Were you sort of like quite happy with the way things were going? Were you surprised at how the I mean, really did explode really from the mid-80s onwards?
Yeah.
Because there was a sort of, you know, the alternative thing. When did it start? 78, 79?
Yeah, 79.
And then it sort of bumbled along quietly and then it just went shoo. And people suddenly launched into mega careers.
Yeah, I suppose it was about mid-80s when it started to be more mid to late 80s, because that's when Friday Night and Saturday Night Live started.
And the Comic Strip Presents movies. When
yeah, but
starting?
Even... but well, that was earlier. I mean, the Comic Strip was, what, from 82 when Channel 4 started?
Movies, really? Was that
yeah, it was, yeah.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah, I think they did one on the first night at Channel 4, didn't they? Five Go Mad in Dorset.
Oh, really?
But what was different about Friday Night Live was the fact that it wasn't exclusively stand-up, but there was always a lot of stand-up on it. And suddenly you noticed that people were coming to the Comedy Store with a different attitude. They were with a bit more respect, ironically, and rather than to heckle. And that certainly started changing really with the TV exposure, and then of course the live scene has exploded over the last 15 years. And frankly, I mean, overall, I think that's great. Sometimes you can get a bit, or I can, let's say, get a bit snitty and snotty about, oh God, you know, some of the rooms you have to work, work real low common denominator stuff. But then again, you know, I think two things. Firstly, well, it means there's more clubs. Secondly, find a way of doing what you want to do. If you're good enough, you can pretty much work any audience, you know. And I basically like the challenge of, you know, thinking, okay, well, if that didn't work, then I'll try it this way. I mean, that's not to say that sometimes when you get up in front of a difficult audience, you don't feel angry and want to blame them. But, you know, I think the fact that it's so, there's so much of it is great. And I also think what is good now is the fact that it almost feels like there's another little subculture within the comedy world starting to happen, where you're getting clubs and promoters and acts as well who want to revitalize it by kicking against that commercial grain again. And that's great as well, you know.
Because I find that very exciting, because I think in the last few years that there has been this pressure to perform, direct gags, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly someone comes in a ballet dress and plays a piece of tubing from a vacuum cleaner, and I'm like, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
It turns out she's a forensic psychologist. It's like, this is brilliant. This is what it should be about. So were you aware during that time that, you know, that it was going to be thin pickings for quite some time, or did you feel that there was a sense that things were going to explode and actually a real career could be, or didn't you really even think like that?
I don't think we did. I mean, as I said earlier, I think we all wanted to make a career in comedy, but exactly what it would be and how, I think was entirely secondary, really. As long as you were, you know, as long as you were able to pay your rent and, you know, survive, and you thought, well, hey, that's great, you know.
That's all we need.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously there's part of you going, well, I want to, you know, win an Oscar for best comedy and, you know, be known as the British Dario Fo and da-da-da-da-da, you know, and be the next Monty Python and the next Woody Allen. You know, there was always that kind of megalomaniac sort of dream time as well. But, yeah, I think really, you just thought, well, we don't know where it's going, but if we can keep doing it, then hopefully we'll keep living off it.
Something will happen. So then, for some reason, which I don't understand, you stopped doing stand-up for 11 years.
Why I did, yeah.
Why did you stop, and was it a did it just stop, or what happened?
I think it was a combination of things. I think I was doing a lot of writing, and it was a simple thing of burning the, you know, rut sitcom and other things, which I was really enjoying, because at that point I didn't really know how to write sitcoms, so that was interesting to sort of learn a new career or a new element. And also, equal to that, the other side of that, I was getting a bit bored with the stand-up because I knew how to do it. Which foolishly now, that's the point where you think, okay, now I know how to do it, I can really start getting properly good at it, you know, when I've lost the fear and I know I can handle the room, so I can just, you know, that's when you really hit the first platform into being good. That's when you can really start to get properly good. But it was almost like I thought, well, I know how to do that now, so I don't need to prove it to myself anymore. Don't know how to write stand-up. Don't know how to write sitcom. Better carry on down that route.
Did you literally decide on Saturday will be my last gig for an indefinite period?
Yeah, pretty much, okay. Yeah. And I did a couple of solo shows, which were more theatre. They were basically comic, but not exclusively, and they were more like a theatre show than a stand-up show. I did them in Edinburgh, and then I toured them. I did Hampstead Theatre with them both. And that was liberating, because I wasn't forced to get a laugh every 15 seconds or whatever. And so it was an interesting project, because it was taking the stuff into a slightly different area again. But yeah, as far as the stand-up's concerned, I can't even remember. I think my last gig was somewhere in Ealing in about, whenever it was, 92. I thought, right, that's it then. And I'll wrap me. Then somebody persuaded me to write a theatre show. I did two of those. But it's entirely different, because you can rehearse it. You can write a script and rehearse it. And however much you write a stand-up show, you know, you only can do it by doing it on stage. And as you know, you've just got to try it out all the time.
It looks brilliant on paper, and you get up there. And you
yeah, exactly.
Why did I think that was ever enjoyable?
Yeah. But you only find that out by doing
rubbish.
It.
You yeah, realize exactly. It sounds like a work of genius. Yeah.
So that's a weird thing with it. And I should have, I think in retrospect, what I should have done was kept the stand-up just ticking over, you know, just so that it wasn't like starting totally from scratch again. But, you know, I was just getting so tired being on the road, coming in thinking, oh, I've got to write 5 pages of this sitcom script before I go to bed, and then I've got to go to Halifax or whatever. You know, so it was that sort of range of reasons, really.
And were there, at that point when you stopped doing it, were there quite a lot of clubs? Were there noticeably more clubs, or were they still quite...
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that was...
cropping up everywhere.
That was early 90s. You had quite a lot of college gigs, and you had... The store was then running certainly twice a week, Thursday and... probably Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Yeah, it would have been. So you'd do 3 nights there, and then Jonglers... at certainly 2, maybe 3 clubs at that point. And then, yeah, you still didn't have permanent gigs in most of the other towns, but, you know, it was starting to be, there was starting to be more of a national circuit.
And were there sort of, see, the other thing that sort of intrigues me is we always talk about the alternative comedy scene as if it was very sort of right on, racially correct, you know, no homophobia, no... And no religious issues, no sexual issues, whatever. Was that actually true? Was that only true of 3 people in South West London? And everybody else was just going, why aren't you Bernard Manning?
Well,
that was the height of his career, really, was it then?
Yeah, I suppose it was. I think there was a sense, though, that you wanted it to be different from what had gone before. And again, you know, to compare it to punk, it was like, oh, well, fuck off lasers and being able to play your instruments, that's all, you know, that's all that's all false, since we're being real. So there was a sense of, right, we don't want to do sexist or racist jokes or homophobic material.
Mother-in-laws.
Yeah, you know, and as I say, I think that was probably, in retrospect, as much of an artistic as a political decision, you know, just to kind of cut away the conventions of the old form as much as possible. And, you know, you didn't have a... There weren't... I would think comparatively, there weren't a lot of people doing overtly political material. You'd have surreal acts and jugglers and all this, as well as people, you know, doing political comedy. But I think that the main way it expressed itself was by an avoidance and a refusal to
follow the other trend paths,
to take those kind of conventions.
And did audiences come in as far as you were aware, you know, if you went to the gig in Halifax or you know, it's the first time comedy had been done in that form in Hull or whatever, but you turned up, were you aware that the audience was coming to you with an air of expectation, thinking this is something new and exciting we're going to receive, or did you
I think
feel
so, yeah.
There was?
Yeah, I think so. Generally speaking, you'd feel that the audience, particularly outside of London, would be the hip people in that town. So you knew that you'd be fairly certain that you could rely on them being interested in the same stories and reading the same papers, or at least be willing to accept that kind of frame of reference. You know, that it was something different from these two comedians go into a bar and tell jokes. You know, it was going to be different. Obviously, sometimes it would be tricky and all that, but most of the time, yeah, you did get that sense that it wasn't a different kind of slightly experimental.
A few mates of mine who I think if their work had been known ahead of being booked, have done things like the Police Federation's ball, or you know, have gone into some prison warders anniversary of something and done their gig there. I mean, quite surprised to find that the prison warders were not necessarily as right on with the comedy as they expected, and I think it's quite an interesting situation. I just wondered whether that sort of thing had happened to you quite a lot, whether, because that corporate comedy thing might have been another whole game.
Yeah, and I mean,
companies,
again,
just for those who don't know, companies hiring you
to
their ball, their Christmas party, whatever.
That's
it
right,
was.
Their conferences and so on. In big hotels, and the great thing about them, of course, is that they pay a lot of money, and so you know you'd be tempted to do them. I used to really they can go one or two ways. They can go really well, actually, or they can be a complete disaster for various reasons, as we know. You know, the way you set up a room and the way that the audience are introduced to the idea of the comedy.
90s,
exactly.
Yeah.
All that really, really makes a big difference, you know. So they can go pear-shaped very easily. But you do get paid well. And again, I used to enjoy the challenge of being able to make that kind of stuff work. And, you know, and if you could throw in some joke that you felt was actually not something that they were supposed to like, they would laugh at it, or indeed if it was just heard and it didn't actually kill off the gig, you know, that was great as well. But you know, just the simple fact of thinking, okay, I'm out of my natural terrain here, let's see if I can make it work, that to me is just as exciting as, you know,
because I would say lots of comics I know now who do the corporate they have almost two sets. They have the one which is, you know, not to malign Bernard Manning because he's a marvellous human being, but lean that way.
Mm.
And then maybe on the club circuit they do something that is slightly more interesting and risky and vibrant, you know, in what they're doing. And I find that kind of interesting, and I'm wondering when that happened or how that evolved. That guys like you were suddenly finding that they were being actually offered huge globs of money to go and do some, you know, Jaguar car launch of...
Yeah,
something,
yeah.
Their new piston.
Yeah. I think it's just, you know, if something's new and trendy, you know, then people, you know, and so the people who, the corporate entertainment bookers and so on, say, oh, you need an alternative comic. Or, you know, we might have been seen on the TV. Can you get us that Ben Elton off the telly? No, but I can get you somebody like him, you know, it would be that kind of thing, wouldn't it? So... Yeah, I don't know. You know, so as regards having two separate sets, I think, you know, I admire any comic who makes a living out of doing it, frankly. You know, that's the bottom line. And it's not, you know, it's not an easy job necessarily. I like to think personally that I'm always trying to find a way of being the same person in every room that you play. I mean, obviously you might select different bits of material and so on, but... I like
still
to think.
Ultimately, you.
Yeah. But you know, still trying to get there.
It's something that I personally love. So I think asked to an inappropriate event and the challenge to make it work.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, being a female, being asked, where the audience is predominantly male, and you know, I had one which is very strange in Putney, and I think it was a 17th or 18th birthday party, and all these beautiful little boys turned up, you know, from the Vespa that Mummy had given them, and they were just having their little gap year before going on to whichever university Mummy was sending them to. And it was all, and that you knew they were all estate agents in the making, you just knew that. And it was such a challenge. And I just thought, hey, we've got nothing in common. And I thought, actually, there's probably in the room, I can't remember, it was about 60, 70 of them in that, and there was a few girls there, but they were very much in the accessory arena of the audience. And and I just thought, actually, I wonder whether there are two people out there who are going to go bug a university and crash their Vespa and do something completely different, who probably in a few years' time could become mates.
Yeah.
And that was what I was sort of like mentally trying to grasp, and I thought there must be, proportionally there must be, but the rest of them, I just thought there's absolutely nothing we have in common at all. There's no level playing field. And it sort of, I think it went generally all right, but that's an element I quite like being thrown into, is just like, wow, how do I get this to turn into something that they're expecting, but actually I can do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, and I was thinking much more on that with the politics and with with the sort of view of what alternative comedy was. There must have been quite a degree, quite a few times where you suddenly went, oh, they're expecting this, I'm actually doing this.
Absolutely. And I mean, it, again, I think it, I mean, the answer is that if you, you know, the, if you're experienced enough and if you're good enough, then you find a way of being able to connect with the audience in the first, you know, couple of moments. And of course, that's much easier said than done, because it is, as you say, it's about finding common ground. And how do you find common ground with certain groups? You know, if they're all consistently younger than you, or if they're all Jaguar piston salesmen or whatever, and they're feeling like that because that's why they're in the same room, then, you know, sometimes it's really hard to find that way into the common ground, or if they're stagnites or whatever it might be, you know. And it just comes down to doing it, and finding ways of having the, you know, having the breadth and trust in your material. Then you ideally start taking them somewhere else once you've got them all on board, you know. You know, it's like, I don't know, if you're on a train or you're on holiday and you get talking to strangers and you have your initial opinion and impression of them, and, you know, sometimes you can end up having quite an interesting journey with them. You wouldn't necessarily want to go home with them, or maybe you would. But the point is, you know, if you actually, if that conversation starts in the right way, you can be taken along on the journey of that relationship.
Which is probably much more memorable than if you initially thought you got on with them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exciting. And, you know, the other thing is, it's like, well, the other weird thing is, what do you want from the audience? You want to make them laugh and you want to get paid. I mean, those are the two basic rules, aren't they? And sometimes, you know, you can go out there and you can feel the aggression from the aggressive people in the audience, or the people who are lively, and it feels like the whole room are like that, and it feels like the people who are being like that are like that all the time. But then gradually, you know, you lose the fear, you gain the ability to be able to surf that energy and use it, rather than feel the need to confront it head on with vicious heckle put downs or whatever it might be. And then you can win them round and take them somewhere interesting. Not every time, but, you know, that's the kind of ideal. And I think it's that sort of basic attitude of thinking, okay, let's connect here, let's trust the fact that they have come to a comedy club to laugh, you know, or to a sales conference to laugh, which of course is a much harder proposition. But that it's always that attitude of thinking, okay, let's include, let's not hate them, let's not try and make that guy not have an erection for the next 6 months just by psychologically damaging him. You know, let's not think about vengeance. Let's think about inclusion. I mean, it's weird, but again, it's the more you do it, the more the the more you think, okay, I've been here before, or I can get out of this, and it's...
Because one of the metaphors I hold in my head is that sort of thing when you're a very small kid and you want all your mates to play your game in the sandpit. And the game hasn't necessarily got rules, but you make them up as you go along.
Yeah, yeah.
And if all your mates love you, or your mummy's got the birthday party and is going to give them all the presents, you're much more likely to have them on board. But the challenge would be if you're actually the interloper, and you've actually turned up in the park and you've just taken over, and actually, you know, everybody else is thinking you're a complete idiot and you turn that around. It's much more exciting, and I think it's very similar from most comics, is it's not that different psychologically.
No.
You can actually watch small children trying to do with a group.
Yeah.
And that placement of that child within the group is quite crucial as to whether the group follows or not, and the child knows it.
Yeah.
And they've got to adapt.
Yeah,
to work
it's extraordinary.
With what they get in the same way.
It's also extraordinary the way that an audience can smell fear. You know, and again, immediately your authority's gone. You know,
back-footed. Yeah,
it's extraordinary.
Again, I think it's very hard to play when you're frightened, whereas you can be away with the fairies, drunk, whatever, and you can still play
if you're relaxed and you know your stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
You can't do it. So what got you going back into doing stand-up?
Every so often, I'd have the urge, and then the urge would go away because I was thinking, it's been a long time. I would need, I'd need at least a year before I could even think of myself as respectable. There's a lot of humiliation and pain to go through. But at the same time, I used to think about it. And then, I suppose, having said that, I'm not particularly... my political and satirical stuff has never been, from a specific focus. I did have an axe to grind. I just wanted to do stuff about the war, the impending war in Iraq, which I just thought was so insane. And I just really wanted to get back up. I found myself riffing stuff in the pub to my mates, and I thought, I'm really rather dominating the conversation here, and I should just actually, if I'm going to do this, I should get up on stage and start doing it again. So when I first started doing it again, I was very much committed to being, taking no prisoners, iconoclastically. Good metaphor for somebody opposed to the Iraq war, taking no prisoners.
Being very vicious.
Yeah, exactly.
Why did you, what would you say would be the difference between, which Tony Allen does, we've already mentioned, one of the early alternative comics, going to Speaker's Corner and letting rip?
Well, quite. Very good question. Why do it in a comedy club? And what I quite quickly... thought to myself was, actually, firstly, in terms of the satirical stuff, less is more. Less is more. If you get the joke on it and you've made your point, then that's enough. You don't have to rant. Also, if you are in a comedy club, you've got to be funny the whole time, and dividing the audience as a matter of design is neither commercially wise in the current climate, nor indeed comedically that desirable, unless you're doing it in a way where you've got enough of the audience with you that the division is actually
part
of the comedy, rather than, I will tell my jokes, you will not censor me, and I just thought, fucking lighten up. Just lighten up and be funny. Just be funny, okay? And also just enjoying the fact.
You tell yourself that a lot,
Hey?
Do you tell yourself that a lot?
I do. Oh, God. But I tell you what, I was up at the Hyena in Newcastle, which can be a tough room to play. I love the room because it's quite a big room and it can be tough because it's in Newcastle and they can have a lot of stag nights in and that. I had a really nice weekend there, three nights, and I felt I got a lot of me sort of big boots back on that weekend, as Gary Delaney put it to me. One of the other comics was up there. But there was such a joy just standing there when my friend Dave Johns was on Killing one night and just watching an audience really laughing and, whatever else is going on. That in itself is just fantastic. And if you're engaging with what interests you, I mean, whatever interests you is going to become your voice, isn't it? And it's great to think, I might have upset somebody there in a very good way by doing a satirical joke. That's great. But the bottom line is, making an audience laugh is just fantastic on its own, you know. And yeah, it's easy to lose sight of that. So that was my sort of journey back into it, very much driven for the first few months and so on, and quite uncompromising in, you know, in terms of not wanting to do any material that I considered cheap. And I just thought, nah, just enjoy yourself and make them laugh, you know.
So. Don't take yourself so seriously.
Yeah, you're only a fucking comedian, for Christ's sake. What makes you think you're so fucking important?
Exactly. So, I mean, do you think you'll stay performing live for a while now?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you see things carrying on much sale, or have you got secret plans that you might not want to talk about?
No,
about
I don't. I don't have any secret plans, really. I mean, you know, I've got a couple of writing projects that will hopefully happen this year. But as far as the live work's concerned, I really like having that as the centre of it now. I'm really enjoying, you know, getting it back together and being able to, you know, hopefully perform quite well. And I just, yeah, that in itself, as long, if I'm earning enough off the live work, then I'm happy, you know, and then write a sitcom, pitch it, see if it goes or not, write for other people if they want me to and I like them, that's great. But I just love it now. I just really do, and I feel I'm really getting it back into a... I really feel I'm getting back to proper match fitness now, you know. And, yeah, so it's great, you know. Yeah, just carry on till... I'd like to see better food in motorway services. That would be my big thing, you know. You have to take your own organic sandwiches.
Little sushi trays.
Exactly, but you can't. You've got to plan ahead, haven't you? You
see, I was going to. That's the sort of thing, we haven't really got time for it now, but that's the sort of thing I'm fascinated by. I mean, there was that wonderful comic strip one with the band. I can't remember what it was, but they were stopping.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful scene with Neil in the trying. They were fighting over one or two sausages for breakfast. Mm. I can't remember what it was, and the hideousness of it, and the awfulness. And I thought, I expect most people from outside Britain won't ever get the joke of just how awful it is and what they're talking about.
At the motorway services,
and things
yeah.
like that. I think that must have changed quite dramatically in the 11 years that you were away. That motorways. I mean, that they do sell proper coffee now, for instance.
Yeah, maybe, but the packaging has changed a bit. But I don't think the food has. Prices certainly. I mean, it really is bloody embarrassing, isn't it? When you it's scandalous when you know, anywhere on the continent you can eat decent food when you're travelling, but it's like, you know, £8 for some pile of fucking additive riddled cholesterol food colouring turd. Yeah.
Well, my bugbear is that there are no trains leaving anywhere from midnight. They leave at 9 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
If you're doing a gig, you just have to have.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Mad. There's many a time I'd love to leave a gig and get on the train and just sit, chill, just thinking about it, instead of which you've got to do all that stuff.
I know.
I agree. That's where I can lose my sense of humour. Thanks a lot for that, Nick.
Pleasure.
That's grand.